Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Adele Oliver about her book published by 404 Inc. as part of the Inkling series titled Deeping It, Colonialism, Culture, and Criminalization of UK Drill, which, I mean, it's a cute, tiny little book that packs a lot in, shining a critical light on UK drill and its various relationships with the British legal system, with histories of colonialism, with really all sorts of things. So Adele, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Miranda. I'm really excited to be here today.
Well, we're very excited to have you, but before we get too far into the excitement about the book, could you please introduce yourself a little bit and explain kind of how and why you came to write this book?
Yeah, I guess to start at the very beginning, the very best place to start. So my name is Adele Oliver. I am a writer. I'm a researcher. I'm a reluctant academic, I guess, from Birmingham. This book was based on my master's dissertation. So I was studying postcolonial studies at SOAS, University of London. And I initially actually came to know about drill music in a academic way. I'd always had a lot of contact with drill because I'm also a music producer, through seeing kind of one way as a music producer to see where culture is shifting is to see what producers in Middle England, usually like 15, 16-year-old kids, are making how-to videos on. So in around 2019, 2020, I was seeing so many how-to-make drill music videos, how-to-make drill beats. And around that time when I was studying my master's, I also came across this group from Thailand called Rap Against Dictatorship, and they had this like anthem, this song, which was to a drill beat, and I became really interested in how this very, in my like my contact with drill is a very UK, the kind of drill that I was listening to or was aware of, very UK based sound, was kind of disseminating globally and as the sound of protest. So then I started to look, take a step back and go to my context in the UK and to see what's happening here. And that's when I really started to research it. So that's what my master's was based on. It was a little more criminological, like a music criminology of UK drill was the title, towards the music criminology of UK drill. So it was a lot more focused on creating like a new framework of understanding music crime in the context of what was happening with drill at the moment, which was, there was a lot in the media, in courtrooms. So I was kind of bringing in my interests, my personal convictions, things that I was interested in terms of post-colonialism, and that being relevant today. So long story short, it was my master's.
No, that's a very helpful story because it I think gives us a bunch of threads to pull on and get into more detail about the book. So starting with kind of the first part of the answer, the kind of quote pure music side before we get to the criminalization aspect, what in the genre makes drill so popular? What sort of things in society have made this such a big thing, as you said, not just in the UK?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because I think when we start there, it kind of reveals so much of the other things that I'm talking about in the book, right? So I think, firstly, what's made drill so popular in a sonic way is how much it pulls from these different musical threads that have been fringe but have become more like mainstream in a way that kind of chips away at the deviance of it that makes it so attractive to especially young people that feel quite disenchanted with what's happening. So I'm talking about like grime, which is its most like obvious predecessor. I'm talking about trap music from the 2010s, Southern American trap, and then going further back to in the UK, like jungle, garage, and then rap as a big broadsheet genre. So drill was and is, like, it's kind of, as all genres do, kind of getting absorbed into the mainstream in a way that requires it to smooth down some of those rough edges. But I think especially when drill was first coming in, the sound was so raw in a way that was quite different to the styles of rap that had become popular. And it's almost like a hypnotic kind of construction of sounds, like these sliding bass lines that kind of like whoosh up and come back down. Super like almost static hi-hat sound, these really like kind of calling in dark twisted melodies, and people talking about things that I think for a lot of people, though, are unfamiliar in terms of like the specific content, are really appealing because they're so to the point, to the very heart of the matter, in a way that was kind of missing in music, I think. And so I think taking that from the UK and the US context outwards, I think there's always going to be a hunger for rap music because of how accessible it feels to kind of just listen to words over music. So I think there's always something there. And as drill being like a new iteration of it, I think that's part of why it's become so popular. And it just being so the most recognizable parts of the genre are the parts that are most, its darkest elements, like it's the lyrics, the ad-libs, the melodies. So in the book, I talk about this concept of dark leisure. So these transgressive liminal alternative kind of activities, and in academic leisure studies, the dark leisure par excellence is like goth culture, metal subcultures. So those have been talked about a lot through this lens. And I think drill also fits in there really nicely with people who are searching for their place on the fringe. And I think drill just provides a really nice home for that.
Mm. Yeah, no, all those pieces very much make sense and kind of pull off of so many aspects, right? It's not kind of coming out of nowhere. It's like, well, there's this thing, there's this. It fits in here and here and here. So thank you for giving us kind of that foundation so that we can talk about kind of what's been done with drill, at least in certain aspects, if we're talking the criminalization side. So turning to that, if we focus on the UK specifically, how has drill music been criminalized in the UK? Perhaps I'll ask that as kind of a part one, where we're at the moment, and then we'll go back in time.
Yes, so this is actually a question I often get because, you know, people aren't really aware of firstly, I think, what criminalization, what that means generally, and then specifically what that means in the context of drill. So when I'm talking about criminalization, I'm talking about how drill has become not just synonymous with criminality, so the people that make it are seen as criminal. The very music is seen as admission of criminal intent, if not actual admission of guilt of doing criminal activity. So one way that this has happened is through drill music being used as evidence in UK courts. So there's something called the Met Police's Drill Music Translation Cadre, which was a specific branch of the Met Police, which was created to have officers as expert witnesses and that translated lyrics taken from drill songs and explained how these related to real life crime. So this is the first time really in UK history that lyrics in this way, artistic expression, have been plucked out of the context of the music or the production onto a page where someone is saying, this specifically means this word means stab, and it was related to this specific incident. So that's one way that it's been criminalized, and that's something that's come up in a lot of recent cases. There was a Manchester 10 case, which was quite well publicized, about these 10 young black boys whose lyrics that they shared over Telegram, so like a messaging service, were used in courts as to reflect bad character and also to as narrative of the murder that they were on joint enterprise on trial for. So that's one way where it's in the most basic legal sense that it's being criminalized because it's been used in, as criminal evidence, right? Then the second way is through censorship. So this was especially towards the beginning of drill, like in 2017, 2018, music videos were being taken down. For the first time in UK history, a song was banned. So AM and Skengdo were not allowed to perform their song, Attempted One. And they were given suspended sentences for performing it. So people are being given injunctions, actual criminal behavior orders that prevent them from performing songs and lyrics. So these are the kind of things that I mean by criminalization, these specific use of legislation, pre-existing legislation that's mapped on to drill music as criminal activity. So these are like the key ways that are the most prevalent.
Yeah, and that's helpful as well, because I think going back to your point about not necessarily being known, there's perhaps the myth that a word like criminalization means, oh, people don't like it. And it's like, no, there's literally legal things happening here that are quite specific. So with that very helpful kind of clarification, in what sorts of ways do you think what's happening now is similar to how other forms of often predominantly black music have been criminalized, either in this very literal form or in the kind of broader sense? If we go back, you know, not just the last 10 years or 20 years, but back a few decades, even back a few centuries.
Yeah, so this is one of the key points that I'm trying to draw out in the book, right, is if we go back, which is why colonialism is the first word that comes after the main title, Deeping It, right? Because my argument is that if we go back into 16th, 17th, 18th century, and look at crime as a concept, a distinctly European concept that was like institutionalized in criminal justice systems created in the early 18th century. And if we look at legislation that was used in UK colonies, so I'm specifically going to talk about an example in the Caribbean, in Barbados, where they had a slave code that called for any kind of musical instruments that were kept in slave quarters, drums, anything that could make any kind of what they called native tune or airs, was to be burnt, to be destroyed. So my argument is that we can draw a direct parallel if we go back, you know, to those times with that kind of slave law, where music, you know, people were going into quarters where the slaves lived, enslaved people lived, and taking those instruments, burning them, because the very existence of them was used as evidence of intent to start riot, to rebel, to resist the institution of slavery, right? And in a way that is not, to me, completely dissimilar, or I think it can be directly linked to that, this music created by black people is being raided. The archives that aren't, you know, physical instruments, but is the archive of drill music that is on the internet, that people are creating music that is blocked from coming into existence, you know, is being metaphorically or for all intents and purposes burnt, you know, censored, removed from existence. So the idea of music being something that's a huge source of potential for dissent is so well documented, especially in terms of Black bodies creating the music and what the narratives through sound actually mean. So I think, in without belaboring the point and going into like the super detailed answer, that is like the thread that I'm following in the book, which goes through not just in the UK or UK colonies, but lots of different former colonies of lots of different European powers.
Yeah, could I ask you to kind of take us to another historical comparison, I suppose, because you also talk about, in some ways, the kind of the question or the link between in what ways is this predominantly Black music being discussed now, and how does this relate to legacies and histories of things like enslaving people, is sort of one aspect of this. But there's also the kind of conversation that isn't always about race that talks about kind of reactions to popular music, regardless of who's making them. And I think it's important to kind of add that piece of it as well, as you do, thankfully, in the book. So can we go back to the sort of mid-20th century and think about the panic, really, around things like the mods and the rockers and what's happening here? So do we see similarities around that with drill now?
Yes, 100%. And that is something that I think is really important to highlight as well. This idea of moral panic that Stanley Cohen kind of coined, this idea of panic around usually youth-driven cultures that are seen as completely against like the fabric of moral society. So as you were saying, in the mid-20th century, like the classic case of moral panic is the mods and rockers, right, who were completely demonized by not just the important thing is not just like the media, but also the legal institution, the systems of political power and their various arms. So the police, politicians were able to create the mods and rockers as this, what Stanley Cohen calls a folk devil. So just a mythologized kind of figure of everything that is immoral, evil, trying to come for the children, trying to undo all of this really important, like spiritual, religious, social, political work that was done in like post-war Britain, you know, to ensure that like our children grow up to be respectable, like upstanding citizens. The mods and rockers were the scapegoats for the undoing of that, you know. So I really, in the book, try and draw this comparison between that, as Stanley Cohen does, like in his later editions of Moral Panic, talks about how there's always, you know, when there's a deep social anxiety or cultural anxiety around something is when the moral panic becomes concretized. Like there's such a panic in the mid-20th century about people turning from religion, about violence, hooliganism, you know, and there's like such an urge, a public urge to have a figure, a representative of all of this worry, all of this deep anxiety to put that on. So I see drill as like a 21st drill, and specifically like drill artists as the 21st century, well, 2020s folk devil, specifically a Black folk devil, as there's like this one thing that's different from the modern rockers is there's always, you know, something that's going to be specifically drawn out. And in this case, it's the racialization of this folk devil, of this figure. The figure is definitely Black and it's usually male, with all this other history of panic around that figure that is pre-existing of like a Black man, deviant, evil, that kind of is pre-made. Like, here's one I made earlier, ready to map onto a drill artist and drill as a genre. So yeah, there are huge similarities there to draw out. And also, as I was saying, when there's a point of deep cultural and social change and anxiety, or something that is like a worry point. And in this case, I think it's knife crime and rising youth violence in general. That is the linchpin of this Black folk devil, the drill artist.
Mm. No, thank you for taking us through that comparison as well. One aspect of kind of the panic, whether it's now or then or further back, that you talk about in the book is kind of some of the language used around music, and the idea that what you and I have been calling music, that isn't always the language used, right? In some senses and sometimes in places, instead the word is noise. How might we sort of understand or critique the criteria that determines when we use the word music versus noise?
That's such an important distinction to make, right? Because the sound is the same, like what we hear, like it's not changing, the wavelength, the frequencies are the same, but it's how it's heard and who the hearer is that changes how it's categorized, right? So I talk about this quote from Belinda Edmondson, who has this amazing work called Creole Noise, and it's about early Caribbean dialect, literature and performance. And she talks about noise as not being merely sound, but a cultural and ideological concept, an audio representation of the other. So the enslaved, the working class, the immigrant. So it's noise is something uncivilized beings, these not quite humans, make. And that is the distinction. It's like, who is making this music for it to be noise? Something that really like made this kind of come to me recently when I was thinking about it. I was on a bus in Birmingham and there was this advert like of an older white man like hunched over these DJ decks with headphones on, and it said like blasting classical, like keep your music to yourself. So the idea was that no one, and this old man wouldn't be playing his music out loud on the bus. So you also shouldn't be blasting whatever music you want to be playing, which made me think of something that had been happening in Los Angeles and like late last year or last the whole of last year with the Los Angeles Police Department blasting this deafeningly loud classical music at train stations to make the environment hostile to keep homeless people away, right? And to keep people from, you know, being delinquent or whatever in the space, where that was very much seen as music, but at a point where you literally can't hear it as anything other than noise because it's so loud, but it's only the decibel level of classical music that makes it feel like it's noise, right? Whereas with these other styles, the very things that I was talking about at the beginning, like the frequencies of the bass, the style of the lyrics, the delivery, is just seen as undecipherable noise. It's nonsense. It's just like there's no musicality in this. Whereas, you know, the musicality of like Beethoven or Bach is like inherent. It's almost like foolhardy for anyone to even question that that's musical, even when it's being blasted at this volume. So there's, yeah, this categorization of music versus noise, and the language that's really interesting to see, especially in like media and political dialogue, how different kinds of music are referred to, reveals a lot about how the ideology of the listener, right?
Mm. In fact, it's on that sort of idea of categorization that I'd like to probe even further. You talk about in the book not just the distinction between music and noise, but also sort of what is considered art or an art movement. Can you walk us through what those criteria tend to be, and therefore to what extent drill actually might fit more than we would assume?
Yeah, so an arts movement basically is a tendency or a style, and it's broken down into like these five key things, requirements. So it's like you have a specified objective or a philosophy. You have that's been adopted and followed by a group of artists, and this happens during a specific period, so it could span like a few months or like decades. And this is collectively adopted by this group of artists and is distinguishable from other contemporary methods, which is the key thing. And then the fifth thing is that it becomes immensely popular and generation defining. So like when we think about art movements and like art, so for example, like key ones like Baroque and Cubism, like these are things that translated across types of medium, right? So you had architecture, you had painting, sculpture, music, and it fulfills those properties I was talking about. You know, there's like, even across those mediums, you can see that the people that are engaging in like Baroque or Cubism or whatever it might be, have like a mutual philosophy or objective. And in the book I map out, my argument is that a drill fits this criteria. I talk about why it's an art, you know, in general, but then also why it's an art movement fitting within this. Because to me, it's so clearly got this objective of being a periscope, of bringing this dark fringe into uncomfortably close. It's like trying to read something that's so close to your face, you can't even make it up. And there's definitely a generation-defining thing. A lot of people that have come to me about this book have been teachers and just been like, you know, this is all my students listen to and have been listening to for the past 5 years. I don't understand it. Something like, but it calls to them so much. So there must be something to it. And that it's spanned now over at least 5 years in like a concrete way. And it's so distinguishable from other things that are happening now. So that's like the way that I see drill as an art movement that can't be just put down to people just, you know, trying to be awkward or just trying to be criminals, you know, and have a soundtrack to it.
Mm. Yeah, no, thank you for taking us through that aspect. And I think it's worth mentioning explicitly, obviously this has been true the whole time, that our discussion in many ways is like a highlights tour version of the book. Yeah, there's loads more detail in the book itself for listeners who want more of that. But moving to another aspect of what you discuss, can you walk us through the significance, if we look at the linguistics, if we look at the names of these genres, rap, grime, reggae, drill?
Yes, this was one of my favorite parts of the book to think about, because
one of my favorite to read.
Ah, amazing, because I'm a linguist at heart. My first degree was in linguistics, right? So I really love to think about not just etymology, but like socially how we are redefining our language through, you know, what it actually means in terms of the definition, what it has meant, and how we've kind of played with them. So like the genres you mentioned, like rap, grime, reggae, drill, all of these are coming from real world, like reinterpretations of really troublesome or violent like concepts or situations, right? So rap is like to strike something like hard, like a series of audible blows. So looking at the lineage of like how we get to rap music from that definition, right? Grime, obviously, like dirt, a layer of it. Reggae is originally comes from, this word means a quarrel, like a row. It's really rowdy, it's raggedy. Drill, that I speak about in the book, like the most easily, like the low-hanging fruit etymology of drill is like the sound of gunshots, right? Which is what is often or used to be referred to often in media, like definitions of what it means. But I really, really love this definition from Mooney of this Chicago hip-hop duo who were like the real innovators in Chicago drill, which is such an important part of UK drill and the drill sound now. And he talks about how drill as a linguistic term is like about getting things done, basically. So people would say, instead of saying I'm getting hype, I'm excited, they'd be like, I'm drill. They called that excitement, that getting ready drill. So, which is very different to the, you know, the audible kind of very material kind of definition of drill as like the sound of gunshots or like that very metallic sound. So I think it's so interesting to look back at these definitions and how, because with the institution of a lot of these genres, or and definitely their predecessors, they were automatically coming from the place that they were perceived as violent, right? So how do you reinterpret that or bring that violence into a form of expression that is artistic, you know? So I think drill is really interesting in that lineage, that linguistic lineage.
Yeah, no, as I said, it was one of the parts of the book I most found intriguing, but not obviously the only one. I'd love to pick up on something you mentioned right at the beginning, the idea of kind of dark leisure. You talk in this section of the book about a claim, quote, drill is like a blood diamond in the rough, right? Which is obviously playing off a whole bunch of pop culture references. How might we think through a statement like that?
Yeah, so I bring that statement out in the chapter of the book called Drill as Commodity. And I think this is such a interesting like statement to value. Like you said, so many different references within that. But the idea of a blood diamond, you know, like conflict diamond, it's been traded illicitly, but it's been traded to finance, you know, some kind of fighting or war effort. So I think the idea that drill is a conflict diamond, a blood diamond in that way, is really interesting to think about when we look at drill now, especially moving from, like I was talking about at the beginning, it being super fringe and that being the appeal of it. And like lots of these genres with like mods and rockers, like grime before it, has kind of become a commodity, become something that can be super profitable because it's so popular. So this idea of it almost financing fighting through like this almost illicit trading in the way that a blood diamond is super interesting because of how much like the machine of big music has kind of chewed up artists and spat them out in a way to kind of finance these lifestyles that are the bloodline, the very like heart of the drill, like lyrics, people talking about life under like austerity in the UK in a very, it coming from like deprived conditions, often, not always. And like music as an industry really capitalizing of that and kind of bringing people out of the rough into these like record deals and stuff, but kind of leaving them out to dry when they encounter this criminalization, right? This censorship or being taken to court, they are left like unsupported because it's no longer profitable. But also for drill to continue to be as appealing as it is, you still need that level of real life danger and as an element to it. So, which is kind of brings to mind like financing, you know, real life conflict, which is interesting.
I'd love to ask, I suppose, a somewhat strange question, given that this is obviously an audio medium. There's no visual element. But the cover of the book is obviously quite striking and very purposely so. So can you tell us a bit about, for listeners who may not have seen the image, kind of what is on the cover of the book and why?
Yeah. So the cover of the book is red, like a blood red. And there's this hand with gloves on, what I perceive to be as gloves, which interestingly, when I did an event, the host saw it as like a shadow, not actually a glove on the hand, but it's in this gesture, like gun fingers. So kind of like your middle and index finger pointed forward with the thumb kind of looking like a trigger and the other two fingers curled behind. So it looks like a gun. And this is also another one of my favorite parts of the book that I talk about, like the history of gun fingers in Jamaican sound system cultures, moving through rave cultures. Like, you'll be very hard pressed to go to any kind of jungle, acid, any kind of real underground dance music, electronic scene, and not see this sign, even if people don't recognize it as like gun fingers. So I thought it was such an important like icon of lots of these Black expressive styles that I'm talking about in the book, and also something that is used so often in drill music, a symbol that has also been pointed to in courtrooms as a gang sign, and is so obviously, or feels like it's so obviously, like a sign of violence, right? It's like a gun. What else is it going to be except a threat? But it kind of, I wanted that to be the iconography, so the reader, I hope, through whatever they think of when they look at that after reading the book, it will kind of be nuanced a little bit more. Interestingly, when I had the first draft of the cover, it was a white hand that the artist drew, which was so interesting to me because it was so far from what I was visualizing, and to me changed what came to mind for me so much. So when I then asked for the glove to be on the hand, which is often also a hallmark of drill music, is that they have gloves on, which the media has also pulled out as an admission of guilt. If you're wearing gloves and you're in all black, you know, it's because you're not trying to leave fingerprints anywhere. So all of those things kind of come together in this cover in a way that's not immediately obvious, but I hope is somewhat provocative in a way that I'm not, is like brings the reader into this journey.
Yeah, it gets people to think. Yeah, no, exactly. So thank you for explaining that here and, of course, in the book as well. As we come towards kind of the end of our discussion, I'm wondering if you can maybe reflect a bit on sort of where we're at and where it looks like we're probably going to stay. The sort of panic around drill music doesn't exactly look like it's going away anytime soon. Why is it sticking?
Well, at the moment, I'm working with part of a new campaign called, well, it's new-ish now, called Art Not Evidence, where we're trying to keep music or art out of UK courts. So keeping creative expression, we've drafted this bill that's hopefully going to be tabled in Parliament later this year about keeping creative expression out of court. So I'm talking about that because I think the moral panic has stuck and has been edified by legal systems, political systems in the UK and abroad, because there's such a tension, or such, like, I think often like a subconscious reticence to see drill as art because of the way it's constructed, like we spoke about, specifically like the sound of it. People think it's quite simplistic and not like artistically complex, firstly, and secondly, how much of the stylistic convention of the lyrics being narrative and first person narrative and storytelling that people really are struggling to see as artistic expression and not just first person narrative of literal criminality. So I think that's something that's really, as I've spoken about, it was going centuries back, of the folk devil, this black folk devil and their musicality, and drill being so irreverent in the way that other music styles have kind of been able to flit in and out of like mainstream imaginary of like, okay, this is art, like it's rap, I don't like it, but I can see there's some kind of, you know, value in this, because it's still really refusing to kind of bend to that in the way other genres have before. I think it's really troubling to see the popularity rise, but it not become less really confronting and violent in its delivery. So I think that is why that has continued to be such a source of panic, in tandem with this idea of like knife crime not getting any better, this idea of like gang violence not getting any, seeming to get any better. So I think that's part of why it's really, really entrenched. It's such a weed in like this garden of panic around the boundaries of what is acceptable in a world that's increasingly fragile, where these boundaries are kind of breaking down. I think people are really desperate to keep them up. So yeah,
I think that's definitely something we'll keep an eye on as things go forward. And I was going to ask anyway what you're working on now that this book is done. You've talked a little bit about it there. Is there anything else you want to tell about your kind of current or future work?
Yes, so as I mentioned, Art and Evidence is something I'm working on at the moment, and which is a really, really important campaign, I think. So there's the legislation side that I spoke about, but also just really highlighting to people or making known what has been happening is something that I'm really trying to do, like post releasing the book, doing things like this, being able to talk about what has happened, what it means, what we can do, which is what the campaign focuses on. I'm also going to be actually doing a PhD later, starting a PhD later this year, which will be building on the ideas in the book, but really looking at, you know, what was thought of as the old world. So how that's happening in like Europe, what's happening with different kinds of like black expression, so drill, but other music styles. And then in the new world, in what was known as the new world, like in North America, South America. And then also these places in the new world that are having new black diasporas. So like Australia, New Zealand, what are the tensions there? How do we like think through these different epistemologies that are coming through sound and resistance? So that's what I'm working on at the moment, and also working with school, going into schools and talking about this work and talking about young people's relationship to drill, and kind of just intervening in the discourse about what it means for them if they like a particular kind of thing, or just what their thoughts are, and really opening up that dialogue for young people as well, rather than it's a lot of us are older speaking around things that are very youth driven. Like a colleague of mine in Art Not Evidence, Kia Montieth, who's a really incredible lawyer who's worked on a lot of cases where drill has been used in courts, he's always says like, old people are not supposed to understand what young people are saying in music. When I was young, my parents had no idea what was going on. And that is just like as it should be, which I think is a really interesting way to think about stuff. So just kind of giving young people the space to have agency over this conversation as well, because it is often talking around them without hearing what they think.
Well, that sounds like quite a lot of things to be getting on with, but very exciting. And I'm so pleased that we could be part of that. So thank you so much for being with us on the podcast. And for listeners who want to read the whole book, it is titled Deeping It, Colonialism, Culture and Criminalization of UK Drill from 404 Inc. Adele, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Miranda. Thank you so much.